KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Some animals display very human behaviors. Chimps grieve. Rats love to be tickled. Moths even remember living as caterpillars. Science journalist Virginia Morell explores the complex minds of animals in her new book, Animal Wise. From field sites to laboratories, Morell shows how animal cognition research has evolved and how animals possess traits many feel are unique to humans. Morell spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 8, 2013.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here this evening. So what my book tries to do is to get into the thoughts of animals and look at how they see and experience the world, and what do we know about that, these thought processes and the emotions that they feel. And how do we know this is because of the scientists who've been studying them. And in the past, it was very difficult for scientists to actually... we've got some other people coming in here. Welcome. So in the past, it's been difficult. It's been a real challenge for scientists to ask these sorts of questions. It was almost a forbidden area of research. And part of that was because, actually, Charles Darwin was the first one who tackled this subject of the thoughts and minds of our fellow animals. And he said, you know, that these two must have evolved. But his evidence for it was largely anecdotal. In other words, he would watch his dogs or he would report on some other observation that he'd made of animals or birds in the wild, and they weren't experiments, things that scientists could replicate. So those are considered anecdotes. And Darwin was really criticized for writing a couple of his books, The Descent of Man and then The Expressions of the Emotions in Man and the Animals. So scientists said, well, no, this isn't the way to go about it. What we have to do is we have to do experiments, and we can't assume anything about animals. And if we do, it's just because we're projecting our thoughts and emotions onto other beings. So when you look at your pet and you think that your pet is thinking something, that's really not the case. It's just you imagining that he or she is thinking something. And that was the way this field remained for many, many years, almost throughout the entire 20th century, until researchers began actually looking at animals in the wild. And some of the biggest breakthroughs came because of the work that Jane Goodall did at Gombe Stream National Park in Tanzania. And I met Jane in 1987. I was there to research a book, my first book, which was Ancestral Passions, about the Leakey family who found the fossils of humans in East Africa and showed that our ancestors had evolved there. And so Jane's work was started by Lewis Leakey, who wanted to see what maybe our ancestors had been something like chimpanzees, and so maybe they would, looking at the chimpanzees living along the lake shores of Lake Tanzania, would suggest that this is how our ancestors also had lived. Now, Jane took me out to see the chimps, and there one day she was giving this one big chimpanzee, Beethoven, a huge bunch of bananas. And Beethoven had this smaller chimp along with him who happened to be an orphan by the name of Dilly. And so Beethoven was usually very kind to Dilly, but in this case, when Jane gave this bunch of bananas to Beethoven, he sat down and just ate all of them. And before doing that, he made a lot of food cries, these kind of hoots that the chimps make to announce to others that, hey, I've got food here. That doesn't necessarily mean that they want to share it with anybody. It's just a general call. Chimpanzees are not known for being particularly sharing or giving to each other. And he certainly wasn't to Dilly, even though he cared for her. And so Dilly sat there and watched every single banana disappear down the gullet of big Beethoven. And then at the end, Beethoven fell on his back, of course, with a very full belly, and went to sleep. And Dilly sat by his side, sort of grooming him. And she happened to glance up, and she caught Jane's eye. Jane was still at this feeding station, and Jane held up one single banana that she had. And it was as if a thought passed between the two of them. Now, Dilly didn't do what scientists would have predicted that she would do. They would say in the past that, oh, if you have a stimulus, like a bunch of bananas, the chimpanzee is going to make a food cry. Stimulus response. Not with Dilly. She was too smart for that, the kind of flexibility of thinking that scientists like to see. Dilly was absolutely silent. And so she watched as Jane set this banana outside behind the feeding station, and then she sort of tiptoed over very cautiously and carefully, sat down. She had that banana down her throat in 3 bites. And then she sneaked back over to Beethoven's side and started grooming him again. He was asleep the entire time and never got any hint, other than maybe later a little banana on her breath. But anyway, so Dilly and Jane sort of, you know, worked together to deceive Beethoven. And I said to Jane afterwards, I said, wow, that was a great demonstration of a chimpanzee deceiving another chimp. And are you going to write about this and publish it somewhere? She said, I can't. I said, what do you mean you can't? She said, well, I'll be accused of anthropomorphizing, and scientists will just say it's an anecdote. You know, it doesn't mean anything. And certainly we cannot say that Dilly deceived Beethoven. If we want to talk about it at all, I would have to say, if Dilly were a human, we would say she deceived Beethoven. But scientists couldn't actually come out and use any words that were suggestive of an animal intending to do anything or thinking anything or feeling anything. It was all in terms of as if or it seems. Now, when Darwin wrote about animals, he never wrote about them that way. His animals do things with intention and purpose. He describes the mating display of the blue-footed booby, where they lift their blue feet up. The males do this to each other, and there's some kind of a competition. And as he put it, they know what they're about. They know that it's a competition. They know what they are doing and that they're competing for mates. It's not that it looks as if they're competing for mates. They are. So reading Darwin is a lot more fun than it is to read a lot of scientific studies, because the scientists, you know, they always want to err on the side of caution. They don't want to fall into the trap of which we often do, which is to be so empathetic with another being, whether it's our computer or our car or a honeybee, that we attribute too much to them. So in my book, I went out, actually, to meet scientists who were finding ways to get around that problem. And another bias that scientists have is the bias, of course, since we have big brains, then that's what you must have to have in order to think and to be intelligent. It must require a lot of neurons. And so we admire that in ourselves. We admire it. Okay, chimpanzees, you know, they're kind of cool, but what's really cool are dolphins, because they have really big brains. So it was interesting to me to meet a researcher who doesn't buy that line of reasoning. His name is Stefan Schuster, and he's an evolutionary biologist, a neuroscientist in Germany. And he works with a particular fish known as an archer fish. These fish shoot blasts of water at their prey, which is generally small insects and lizards, which are perched on a twig or on a leaf or something like that, and then the prey falls into the water. And Schuster showed that they had to make many, many calculations in order to make these shots. They vary the amount of water that they blast at an insect, so they're not shooting just any old amount of water to knock them down, but they actually have some way to calculate the force with which that animal is holding onto the leaf or the twig. So if they're targeting a lizard, they shoot a stronger bullet than if they're shooting at, say, a small spider. They also have to account for the refraction of the light hitting the water, and they have to calculate when the insect begins to fall. They make another calculation that tells them where their prey is going to land. And, of course, they make all these decisions very, very fast. Their shots are fast, and then they turn their body into a C shape and launch themselves to get their prey. And so when he first began to write about their brains, he was told, well, what the fish do isn't thinking, because they do it too fast. And he said, so if they did it more slowly, it would be thinking? So it's interesting, these biases that we come to this field of research with. His big idea, as he put it, is that even animals with small brains can be intelligent. Intelligent circuitry can be assembled in any brain. That's my big belief, Schuster told me. It's not limited to those animals with large brains and many neurons. If evolution requires it, this kind of intelligent circuitry, it will be assembled even with a small number of neurons. He said he chose fish because people just don't think of them as being making any kind of intelligence or complex decisions because people don't expect much from them. So after we talked a little bit about how stupid most people think fish are, he said, come meet my archer fish, which were housed in an adjoining lab. The archer fish caught my eye the moment I walked into Schuster's lab. 8 silver and black dappled fish looking back at me from inside a wide square tank. As big as the palm of my hand and shiny, they were shaped like Paleolithic arrowheads, broad and flat with pointy heads. They weren't swimming in slow laps or zooming back and forth as aquarium fish often do. They were lined up in a row at the front of the tank, their dime-sized black eyes fixed on us. There was something so expectant in their pose and attentive gaze that I turned to Schuster and said, are they waiting for you? Of course, as soon as I said that, I blushed and thought to myself, what a stupid question. Of course the fish aren't waiting for him. I expected to see him wince. But Schuster was beaming. Yes, yes, it looks that way, he said, stretching his neck toward the tank. I noticed he didn't get too close. They have these large eyes, and they do watch us as we move around the room. They shoot at us, too, said Mario Voss, one of his students. Like this. Voss stepped up to the tank and leaned his head over the edge. The fish turned toward him, and in the next second, one blasted Voss in the eye with a sharp jet of water. Ow, cried Voss, jerking his head back and laughing as he wiped away the water. A good shot. Thomas Schlegel, another one of Schuster's students, was completing his doctorate, and he didn't approach the tank. He'd been dodging water bullets for 4 years and was tired of being a target. They shoot us in the eyes and the nose all the time, he said. It can be irritating after the 30th time in one day. But you should try it. So I was game. I stepped to the tank's edge, leaned in, and concentrated on keeping my eyes open. Which fish would be the shooter? The fish were all facing me, but one in particular seemed to be staring directly at my left eye, like a hunter targeting his prey. Wham! The water hit my pupil with such force that I jerked back, just as Voss had. It was like being shot by your kid brother's high-pressure water pistol. Laughing, I wiped my left eye, but stayed by the tank, my left hand resting on its edge, kind of like that. Another fish quickly seized the opportunity to blast the diamond in my engagement ring, while a third one targeted the red carnelian stone in my earring, this very pair, and another one shot my right eye. So there were like water bullets coming in all directions. They are really good, I said, jerking back. But do they think my eyes and earrings are insects? Oh, I think they can tell what is an eye and a nose or earrings, Schuster said. They don't react like they expect this prey to fall into the water, so they didn't go into this C shape or launch themselves. But eyes and noses do interest them. Maybe they just like our reaction, said his student Schlegel. Most of the time it must be boring for them since they're just waiting for us to set up experiments. So shooting our eyes might be fun. We stood there in a row, the four of us looking at the row of archer fish who'd lined up again to look back at us. What were they thinking? One of the archer fish waggled his head, stopped, and then did it again. I could never prove it, but I always think when he does that, he's trying to get me to feed him, said Schlegel. He often worked by the tank with his back to the fish. Sometimes I get the feeling they're watching me, he said. And when I turn around to look at them, there they are, lined up like this, waiting like humans for their dogs. Or sorry, the other way around, waiting for their like dogs for their humans. They try to catch your attention. Most people don't look for learning or playful behavior or thinking or feelings in fish, said Schuster. They think they're just, you know, wet vegetables, carrots or cabbages with fins. Then they meet our archer fish. The fish look at them and shoot them in the eyes, and immediately people think, well, these fish are intelligent. That suggests to me something interesting about people. We like predators, or as long as they don't eat us, you know. We think that being a predator, though, must have something intelligent to go along with it.
Virginia Morell, the author of Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 8, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drews recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Virginia Morell in a moment. 821-94.9 KUOW. One liberal and one conservative talk about a mail-out of ads attacking Liberal Party leader Justin Trudeau. Also, an employee at a historic library stole 1,000 books in the 1970s, admitting it in a letter released after he died. One Bangladesh clothing worker tells how she escaped the garment factory building that collapsed yesterday. And Nova Scotia Minister Marilyn Moore talks about her government's new bill to address cyberbullying. All these items tonight at 11 o'clock. Forecast says lows in the 40s tonight for the Seattle area, partly cloudy this evening, then becoming mostly cloudy late tonight. Patchy fog after midnight, too. Friday highs around 70, mostly cloudy in the morning, then becoming mostly sunny, patchy fog in the morning, too. Friday night lows mid to upper 40s, partly cloudy in the evening, becoming mostly cloudy. Saturday highs down to around 60 degrees, mostly cloudy, chance of rain.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Animals possess traits many feel are unique to humans. That's what science journalist Virginia Morell writes about in her new book, Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. Morell spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 8, 2013. Next, she continues sharing stories from her book.
So another person who worked with an animal that was thought to be dumb was Irene Pepperberg, She works with African gray parrots, and she had one in particular called Alex for avian learning experiment. And she got this parrot 30-some years ago at just a pet store in Chicago. She stopped in one day and had the owner pick out a bird for her so that no one could say, oh, you chose a particularly smart bird. Now, at the time that she got Alex, which would have been, I guess, the late 80s, sometime in the 80s, birds were disparaged as having bird brains. I mean, you could, you know, insult someone by saying, well, you've got a bird brain. And that was because people who had looked at the anatomy of bird brains decided that they were missing the key parts that we had that made higher cognitive thinking possible. So even if Alex could do smart things, it must be some kind of a trick on her part, because he didn't have the neural anatomy with which to do it. And what Irene set out to do was not to show that Alex could understand human language, but that if she taught him how to mimic certain words, which she just called labels, that she could then ask him questions about how he sees the world. And so I made an appointment and went to meet Alex and Irene to find out what was going on in the bird's brain. Now, at this point in time, when I met Alex, it was about the year 2005, and birds had finally been recognized as having brains. One of the scientists who helped make the discovery said, well, think about the difference between the way our brain is shaped and that of birds is that ours are shaped more like a club sandwich with all the layers stacked on top, and a bird's is more like a pizza with all the pieces spread out around. Fish, too, we were often led to believe that they didn't have the parts for thinking, and that was because fish's brains look sort of like potatoes. All the key parts are actually on the outside of their brains, as we've come to learn, but earlier on, scientists always were looking inside because all of our key neural anatomy is inside our brains. So, of course, they weren't finding anything like that until they looked for structures on the exterior. So this is my description of meeting Alex, the African gray parrot. I've met Irene, and she and I walked to the back of the room where Alex sat on top of his cage, preening his pearl gray feathers. He stopped at her approach and opened his beak. "Want grape," Alex said. "He hasn't had his breakfast yet," Pepperberg explained, "so he's a little put out." Alex closed his eyelids halfway, hunched his shoulders, and looked at her. His narrowed eyelids and hunch made him look crabby. "Don't look at me like that," Pepperberg said to him. "See, I can do it too." She narrowed her eyes and gave him a stony look, imitating his expression. Alex responded by bending his head and pulling at the feathers on his breast. "To me," she said, "he's in a bad mood because he's molting, and sometimes when he's like that, he won't work." She spoke to Alex again. "You'll get your breakfast in a moment." "Want wheat," Alex said. So they put together a little bowl of green beans, grapes, apple and banana slices, shredded wheat, and then she'd hold up these sliced fruits and vegetables for him. If he didn't want something like the green beans, he said, "Nah," meaning no. It was an emphatic "nah," short and decisive. His voice had a slightly nasal and digitized quality, but it was also tinny and sweet, like the voice of a cartoon character. It made you smile. Under her patient tutelage, Alex had learned how to use his vocal tract to imitate about 100 English words or labels, including the sounds for all of the foods she offered him, although he called an apple a banary. Apples may taste a little bit like bananas to him, and they look a little bit like cherries, so Alex made up that word for them, Pepperberg told me. Alex could count to 6, and he was learning the sounds for 7 and 8. "I'm sure he already knows both numbers," Pepperberg said. "He'll probably be able to count to 10, but he's still learning to say the words. It takes far more time to teach him certain sounds than I ever imagined." Alex was also learning to say brown. As a kind of learning aid for brown, Pepperberg placed a small wooden block painted chocolate brown next to Alex. So after breakfast, after Alex preened again, he used his claw to pick up the toy block. He held it aloft as if showing it to everyone in the room, just like that. Then he opened his beak. "Tell me what color." "Brown, Alex, the color is brown," Pepperberg and her two assistants replied in a kind of sing-song unison. They stretched out "brown" into almost 2 full syllables. Alex listened silently. Sometimes he tried part of the word, "brown." Other times he again held up his block and repeated his question, "What color?" And the trio of humans replied again, "Brown, Alex, the color is brown." Then he switched to the number 7. "Snan." "That's good, Alex," Irene said. "7, the number is 7. Snan, snan." So I was wondering, you know, I mean, this is quite remarkable to watch and to listen to, but what on earth was Alex doing? So I asked Irene, what is he doing? She replied, "He's practicing. That's how he learns. He's thinking about how to say each word, how to use his vocal tract to make the correct sound." It sounded a bit mad, the idea of a bird willingly engaging in lessons and learning and practicing. But after listening to and watching Alex, I found it difficult to argue with Pepperberg's explanation for his behaviors. She wasn't handing him treats for the repetitious work or rapping him on the claws to make him say the sounds. She told me that he has to hear the set words over and over before he can correctly imitate them. "I'm not trying to see if Alex can learn a human language," she added. "That's not the point. My plan always was to use his imitative skills to get a better understanding of avian cognition." In other words, because Alex was able to produce a close approximation of the sounds of some English words, she could ask him questions about a bird's basic understanding of the world. She couldn't ask him what he was thinking about because that was beyond his vocabulary. But she could ask him about his understanding of numbers, shapes, and colors, abstract thoughts. To demonstrate, Irene carried Alex on her arm to a perch in the middle of the room. She then retrieved a green key and a small green cup and held these two items up to Alex's eye. "What's same?" she asked. Without hesitation, Alex's beak opened. "Color." "What's different?" Pepperberg asked. "Shape," Alex said. Since he lacked lips and only slightly opened his beak to reply, the words seemed to come from the air around him, as if a ventriloquist were speaking. But the words and what can only be called the thoughts were entirely his. So she put him through a number of experiments showing that he understood what was different in terms of materials such as wool versus wood versus metal, and had him do a number of counting exercises. And then, as if to offer final proof of the mind inside his bird brain, Alex spoke up. "Talk clearly," he commanded when one of the younger birds Pepperberg was teaching mispronounced the word green. "Talk clearly." "Don't be a smart aleck," Pepperberg said, shaking her head at him. "He knows all this, and he gets bored, so he interrupts the others, or he gives the wrong answer just to be obstinate. At this stage, he's like a teenage son. He's moody, and I'm never sure what he'll do." "Wanna go tree?" Alex said in a tiny voice. Alex had lived his entire life in captivity, but he knew that beyond the lab's door there was a hallway and a tall window framing a leafy elm tree. He liked to see the tree, so Pepperberg put her hand out for him to climb aboard. She walked him down the hall into the tree's green light. "Good boy, good birdie," Alex said, bobbing on her hand. "Yes, you're a good boy, you're a good birdie," and she kissed his feathered head. Alex died a few years, 2-3 years after I met him, and when I met Alex with Irene, she'd emphasized, you know, that he was her colleague and that she was dispassionate about him. But when Alex died, of course, it broke her heart. Another researcher who had a wonderful relationship with his animals was a man by the name of Lou Herman at the University of Hawaii. He worked with captive dolphins, which is an area that's highly debated these days whether or not that's a good way to treat dolphins. Certainly we don't like to see any dolphins captured in the wild, brought into captivity. These dolphins had been captured by the Navy, and there was a lot of interest at that time because of Lilly's earlier studies on looking at the dolphins, the size of the dolphin's brain, and then their ability to imitate some English words, and the imitation which they do with their own vocal sounds. So this scientist, Lou Herman, had actually started out trying to understand learning in animals, and he'd worked with rats until he was at the University of Hawaii, where one of his students kept saying to him, "Why, if you're living here in Hawaii, why are you studying rats? You should be studying dolphins." So he met some people who had captive dolphins that they were studying, and then through the Navy had several that were given to him to work with. So one of the things that he did was to invent a language to communicate with the dolphins. It was an arm and hand gesturing language, and it had a grammar in it. So he could do things such as, he could give them a request such as hoop, ball, fetch, and the dolphin would push the ball to the hoop. If the word order was changed, ball, hoop, fetch, so switching the two nouns, the ball and the hoop, then she would carry the hoop to the ball. Over time, the dolphin could interpret more grammatically complex requests such as right basket, left frisbee in, which asked her to put the frisbee on her left into the basket on her right. And if he reversed left and right, the dolphin would reverse her actions. And Lou explained that he wasn't trying to show that dolphins had a language, but that they understood grammar. They could follow the order of words, that they had some sense of logic. So he showed me some films of what his dolphins were able to do. "Here's a Lele," Herman said, showing a film of her following a trainer's directions, which were surfboard, dorsal fin, touch. Without hesitating, Alele swam to the surfboard and, leaning to one side, laid her dorsal fin on it, an untrained behavior. The trainer stretched her arms straight up, signaling, "Hooray!" and Alele leaped into the air, squeaking and clicking with delight. To accomplish this task, Alele had to understand the gesture directions and to use a body part, her fin, that she could not see but had to picture in her brain. "Alele just loved to be right," Herman said. "And she loved inventing things. We made up a sign for create, which asked a dolphin to create its own behavior. Dolphins often synchronize their movements in the wild, such as leaping and diving side by side, But scientists don't know what signals they use to plan their moves or to stay so tightly coordinated. Herman thought he might be able to find out how with his pupils. In the film, the dolphins Akea, Kamai, and Phoenix are asked to create a behavior and to do it together. The two dolphins swim away from the side of the pool. They circle together underwater for a few seconds, then leap out of the water, spinning clockwise while erect and squirting water from their mouths, every maneuver done at the same instant. None of this was trained, Herman said, and it looks to us absolutely mysterious. We don't know how they do it or did it. And he never will. Akea, Kamai, and Phoenix, and Herman's two other dolphins died in 2003 after developing an infection that didn't respond to treatments. I might try again, Herman said, but he shrugged and his voice trailed off. He was an emeritus professor now and busy with a study of humpback whales in the wild. He wasn't sure about beginning again with captive dolphins, and he gathered so much material from his dolphin study that he was still writing papers about it. I loved our dolphins, Herman said, as I'm sure you love your pets. But it was more than that, more than the love you have for a pet. The dolphins were our colleagues. That's the only word that fits. They were our partners in this research, guiding us into all the capabilities of their minds. When they died, it was like losing our children. Herman pulled a photo from one of the files. In it, he's in the pool with Phoenix, who rests her head on his shoulder. He's smiling and reaching back to embrace her. She's sleek and silvery with appealingly large eyes, and she looks to be smiling too, as dolphins always do. It's an image of love between two beings, two vastly different creatures, one of land and one of sea, having what Herman said he'd most wanted with his dolphins, a meeting of the minds.
Virginia Morell, the author of Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 8, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drews recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Virginia Morell in a moment, 838 94.9 KUOW. The Senate is considering an internet sales tax bill, a look at what the measure could mean for consumers, online retailers, and brick-and-mortar stores tonight at midnight. Lows in the 40s tonight, says the forecast. Partly cloudy this evening, then becoming mostly cloudy late tonight. Patchy fog after midnight to boot. Friday, highs around 70, mostly cloudy in the morning, then becoming mostly sunny, patchy fog in the morning. Friday night, lows mid to upper 40s, partly cloudy in the evening, becoming mostly cloudy. Saturday, highs down to around 60, cloudy, actually mostly cloudy, to quote the forecast directly. Mostly cloudy, chance of rain on Saturday. A look at how some Seattle residents are donating birds that fatally collide with their windows to science. Also, Gloria McMillan, who played alongside Eve Arden in the popular radio comedy Our Miss Brooks, talks about the cast, about Hollywood, and about what it was like to work in radio. And a look at how the state of Colorado's system for regulating medical marijuana works. And at how both Colorado and Washington might regulate recreational marijuana production and sales. All these items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Virginia Morell is a science journalist and the author of Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 8, 2013. Next, she continues talking about animal cognition research.
That desire to really understand the mind of another animal guides most of every researcher that I met. I mean, it's why they go into become an animal behaviorist. It's why they go into animal cognition research. For many years, the animal who's perhaps closest to us and shared so many things with us was not, however, allowed into animal cognition labs. And that animal was a dog. And the reason dogs weren't allowed was because they were supposedly artificial animals, animals that we had made, and therefore they weren't real. They also happened to have smaller brains than their wild ancestors, the wolves. This is a pattern that we see in every domesticated animal. It also applies to us. Our brains are smaller, that we've become Homo sapiens sapiens, than they were prior to our undomesticated era. So how did it, you know, nowadays you just see books everywhere about dogs and how smart they are. The Genius of Dogs is just out by my friend Brian Hare. He's a researcher at the University of Duke, or Duke University. But Brian wasn't the first one who's thought about studying dogs. That actually goes to a researcher in Hungary by the name of Vilmos Csányi, and this is the story about how he came to study dogs. One day in late November 1989, while setting out on a hike with his wife Eve in a range of mountains in Hungary, Csányi spotted a stray dog. The dog, which was small, fuzzy-furred, and male, proceeded to follow Csányi and his wife. After about 5 miles, the dog seemed to tire, so Csányi picked him up and carried him the rest of the way. The next day, Csányi, his wife, and the dog, whom they'd named Flip, returned to the Chinese home in Budapest. They went home a day earlier than they'd originally planned because the inn where they were staying wouldn't allow dogs in the room, and now they had one. Or the dog had its humans. Either way, the unexpected friendship also unexpectedly opened the door on a new field of research, the study of the minds of dogs. At the time that he and Flip found each other, Csányi was the head of the ethology department at a leading university in Budapest. He and his students were focused on the learning abilities and mechanisms of the paradise fish. They'd made several major discoveries. Their research was well known, highly regarded, and they had an excellent international reputation. But this fish research was becoming very boring, Csányi told me one evening in February 2009 in his Budapest flat. He had an elderly blonde mixed-breed dog, Jerry, at his feet. Flip had died some years before. Csányi himself was now silver-haired and retired. We were repeating our fish experiments with mice, and we were publishing good papers, but I felt we needed to change our focus. After bringing Flip home, Csányi started a diary about him. He noted that Flip appeared to pay close attention to what his humans were saying and to understand what was about to happen, such as a walk, a car ride, or the arrival of food. He made notes about things such as how Flip would make him realize there wasn't any water in Flip's bowl, or how Flip would ask him questions by sitting in front of him and looking at him questioningly, or how Flip would use his nose to poke Csányi in the morning to rouse his master from bed. He also began to share his dog stories with the members, the students of his lab. Yes, Csányi would come in and tell us some unbelievable story about Flip and ask us, why do you suppose he did that? Recalled Adam McCloshy, who was one of Chinese students. And then he would say, you boys, you students, figure out an experiment to test that, to show why Flip can do that. Everyone would have a very long face because in those days, no one would think that you're a serious scientist if you're studying dogs. So what Csányi said about that was, well, you know, of course, people might say these things, but he didn't worry about whether his lab would be derided for studying the minds and behaviors of dogs. You would never make a scientific discovery if you only thought of your colleagues' reactions, he said. Besides, he was as intrigued as Darwin had been by the transition from wolf to dog. And because so few people were studying dogs, Csányi thought that canines offered a rare research opportunity. Of course, I saw the many dark expressions on my students' faces when I would tell them some story about what Flip had done. Okay, that wasn't science. But these kinds of things, my stories or anecdotes, eventually gave us ideas for experiments, good experiments. Experiments, it should be said, that changed the science of animal cognition and ethology, helping to expand both fields. Today, researchers embrace the study not only of dogs, but of domesticated animals in general, which are no longer considered simply dumbed-down versions of their feral ancestors. Dogs, in fact, are now regarded as excellent subjects for understanding how evolution can shape and transform a species' brain, and for studying the mental building blocks that involve social cognition. His work has also inspired many other researchers, and I went to Austria to meet two, Friederike Range and Sophia Varagni, who are raising dogs and wolves together to get a better understanding of how dogs' minds changed from their wolf ancestors. And the wolves that they've used in their research come from wolf farms where the wolves are raised in captivity. They are given the wolves before they open their eyes, because wolf pups, after they open their eyes, you can never socialize them. They will never be comfortable around humans. So you have a very short window, about 7 to 10 days, in which to bring in wolf puppies. So they get these small wolves, and then they hand rear them and treat them very much like you would a wolf or a dog puppy. But that doesn't mean that the wolves are dogs. And so Sophia took me out to a field to show, you know, how different wolves and dogs are, even at this very young age. And that they had older dogs that were sort of serving as elders or guides for the wolf pups. Whatever the dogs did, like if they sat or followed human directions to sit or come or stay, then the wolf puppies were learning those behaviors from the dogs. But there were other things that were just absolutely wolfish that they couldn't easily overcome. And this was one of the training experiments that Sophia was doing to try to get this young wolf, Tatanga, who is about 4 months old, to look Sophia in the eye, something that is very difficult for wolves, as it is for most wild animals, because staring is generally a threat. Sophia asked Tatanga to sit a few feet in front of her and held up a treat for her at arm level. Each time Tatanga met her gaze, Varagni snapped a clicker while simultaneously tossing the wolf the treat. Sometimes Tatanga looked straight at Sophia, other times she tilted her head from side to side as if unsure where to focus. So she'd kind of do this funny head thing. She can only manage it for a second or two, or she'll look at me from the corner of her eye, Varagni said after the 2-minute lesson. The wolves know they must do something to get that treat, but they really aren't sure what it is. They think maybe it's about moving their head in a particular way, which is why she does that funny head wobble. And even when they figure it out, they can't do it like a dog does, or the one that looks openly into your eyes. When I speak to my dog, Todor, he turns instantly to focus on me, to gaze at my eyes. It's like he's asking, what do you want me to do, or what do you want me for? Wolves don't think that way. They're too busy thinking for themselves. And as a further example of that thinking for themselves, she told me this story. They had to have an electrical fence around the wolf's enclosure, where they were required to do so by Austrian law. And she talked about how different the wolves reacted to this buzzing sensation that the electrical wire caused when they touched it versus her dog. Varagni had touched the wire herself to understand the buzzing sensation. It didn't really hurt, but it is a weird feeling, she said. When one young wolf received her first shock, she silently turned back to the wire and from only an inch away inspected it closely with her nose. She seemed to know this thing caused the weird feeling, Sophia told me. In contrast, when her dog Todor was shot, he ran screaming and howling straight to Varagni and hid between her feet. He growled in the direction of where this bad thing had happened to him, but he had no clue where the pain came from. If anything, he thought the people standing close to that spot had done it to him. Wolves, she concluded, seem to take many more things into account than do dogs, whereas for dogs, humans are more important than anything else. Of course, we all wonder how far back in time does our friendship with dogs go? It's something scientists are still puzzling over. They may have narrowed the gap a little bit. The genetics show that it could be as long ago as 100,000 years. The archaeological record, I think the earliest burials of dogs is about 14, 15,000 years ago. But archaeologists, paleontologists are also finding these interesting kind of wolf-dog fossil skulls that go back as far as 32,000 years ago. And then more recently, there is a new study out that shows that our ancestors, Homo sapiens sapiens, arrived in Europe only about 65,000 years ago. And it's Vilmos Chiney's contention, and many other dog researchers believe that as soon as our species came into Europe, we got together with the dog. And it may actually have been one reason that we were successful against Neanderthals. This is my thoughts about those discoveries and our friendship with dogs. In France's oldest decorated cave, archaeologists have traced images of animals, lions, horses, rhinoceroses, and elephants, that the artists of 26,000 years ago painted on the rock walls. They found the skulls of cave bears and measured the tracks of cave bear paw prints. And in one chamber, they found the footprint of a child. There are no other human footprints with this young person who stood about 4.5 feet tall. But there is another nearby footprint, a dog's, or a dog wolf's. They know the canid was more dog than wolf because of the length of its middle toe, which is like that of a dog's. The archaeologists investigating the cave cannot say for certain if the child and dog were together or if they came to the cave at separate times. But most of us would say the child and dog were surely there together and that they were friends, looking out for each other. So natural does it seem, even 26,000 years ago, for humans and dogs to be a pair, working together as a team. Now, at the end of my book, I have a very short chapter about what does it mean now that we know that animals have thoughts and emotions, and scientists have shown this in so many species, and there's hardly a week now that goes by that you don't hear about some new remarkable discovery. I think just recently there was a study showing that chickens must have some form of, how would they phrase it, proto-consciousness or some self-awareness. For myself, you know, there's a discovery that I talk about in the book about the discovery of pain in fish, and the researcher was roundly criticized for this and asked by a group of human psychologists, so where is it going to stop, and are you going to ask next, do insects feel pain? And her response was, well, why wouldn't we want to know, and wouldn't it be interesting to find out? Why would you stop, you know, why would you not ask that question? And if insects don't feel pain, why not? Because it's such a useful reaction to have. I think the same thing is true, not just for pain, but and for fear or aggression, the kinds of emotions we normally allow out animals, but I suspect it's also true for love and grief. Scientists are limited in their vocabulary for describing these emotions. They don't want to suggest that it's identical to what we feel, so they'll say for love, affiliative behavior, things like this. I think that as we get closer to studying animals and seeing more about what goes on neurologically in their brains and the chemicals which are associated with their thoughts, they'll discover that they're more and more like ours, because evolution is a very conservative force. It doesn't go about reinventing things. It uses what works. So if pain cell receptors work, then you don't throw them away. You keep them and you retain them, and they work the same in fish and in birds and mammals and of course in us, the highest mammal, as we like to think. So, you know, I've thought a lot about this issue, and it seems to me that even though there is this tendency in scientists to say, well, if you think about animals having love or sorrow or grief or playfulness, a sense of joy or happiness, any of the positive emotions, that you're simply romanticizing, you're just simply doing, you know, what we do so well, going beyond what an animal is actually doing. And my thinking is that, in fact, it is what scientists are striving for. They always want what they call the most parsimonious explanation for something, which means the most logical and simplest explanation. And it seems to me that in terms of evolution, it's that you would want to conserve something such as love, that it has great benefits, especially for rearing your offspring. So why would you reinvent that emotion if it serves you well, whether you are a shark or a parrot or a Homo Neanderthal? I think that these are just things that have worked well, and we know they must have a biological past. What are the roots of all of these things? And that's what evolutionary biologists are searching for now. And it's important for us to recognize this because we are living in a time of great extinctions. We're losing species because of climate change, but we're also losing most species because of habitat loss. There are so many people now on the planet that we are just forcing other species into either inappropriate habitats for them or off the planet entirely. Or we're killing them at unprecedented rates. The slaughter that's taking place now of the elephants in Africa can't endure much longer before we lose those magnificent creatures and their minds. You know, it's not just the loss of the bodily form of the elephant and animal with fabulous tusks, but their minds too. There is grandeur in this view of life, Darwin concluded at the end of his book On the Origin of Species about the power of natural selection. Through natural selection, he wrote, endless forms, most beautiful and wonderful, have been and are being evolved. By forms, Darwin meant the splendid variety of physical shapes and structures of animals, the simple fleshy tubes of worms, the hard jewel-like encasements of beetles, the basic four limbs and one head body plan of vertebrates, whether clothed in scales, feathers, fur, or a veil of body hair. No matter how different our morphology, we animals are basically alike because of our shared evolutionary past. But animal bodies are not empty forms. They are equipped with sensory cells and brains. In his later works, Darwin argued that these internal structures and their accompanying thoughts and emotions evolved as well. With the endless forms have come endlessly beautiful and wonderful minds. It is our good fortune to be living among them. It is a tragedy to lose a single one to extinction. What do the minds of animals tell us about ourselves? That, like us, they think and feel and experience the world. That they have moments of anger and sorrow and love. Their animal minds tell us that they are our kin. Now that we know this, will our relationship with them change? Thank you so much.
Virginia Morell, the author of Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on April 8, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drews recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Kirkland Choral Society, presenting Songs of America with the rich heritage of American music, with songs such as O Shenandoah, Buffalo Gals, and more. Saturday, April 27th at 7:30 p.m. at Bastyr University Chapel. Tickets at kirklandchoralsociety.org or brown paper tickets. 9 o'clock, KUOW FM 94.9, Seattle. 1340, KUOW Tumwater. 90.3, KQOW Bellingham. And Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Comedy and...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.